Can I take you home?
There's nothing cuter than a baby or a puppy.
Who's your good boy?
I'm Kurt Anderson. Today in Studio 360, we'll try to figure out why we love cute, cuddly things so much. We'll hear from the Andy Warhol of Japan about what he thinks is a direct line between the atomic bomb and Hello Kitty.
When I looked into the history of the A-bomb, I learned that the bombs were named Little Boy and Fat Man. That's how Japan is now. We're like children.
Plus, smart indie pop from the Canadian band Stars. Stuck on the world, note that you left. I waited still for the moment. That's all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of PRI's Studio 360, where each week, Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. Studio 360 can be heard on public radio stations across America. Please help support the show by becoming a member of your local station. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Oh, what a cute face.
How much is that dog in the winter?
Oh, you're too adorable.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and those people are not talking about me, sadly. A little Norfolk Terrier puppy is cuter than any 50-year-old man by approximately a zillion times, especially if the dog fits in a duffel bag and pokes his little nose out the opening. But what is so cute about him?
Poochkilla.
Poochie. You like it. Oh, my God.
Let's take it. Come on.
Seriously, why do a bunch of hard-nosed New York media types have the urge to pet and coo over somebody else's dog, a dog who probably chews the rug and eats his own poo? Why did people, when I was growing up, buy those paintings of children with the giant eyes like saucers? And when is cute too cute?
Is he really a puppy, though?
He's a puppy.
He's faking it.
He's under a year.
He's
a puppy.
He's pretending to be a puppy. He's faking it. See right through you, buddy.
The person who can answer these and other urgent questions is Gary Cross. He wrote the book on cute, the only history of the subject in print, I believe. And he's fairly cute himself for a distinguished professor of modern history. Gary teaches at Penn State University, and he's my guest today in Studio 360. Gary Cross, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you.
Let's get one thing straight right away. Which is cuter, babies or little puppies?
Well, I think it depends on the eyes of the beholder. Actually, the word cute was first used for dogs and then for babies. When you ran that clip of your colleagues gushing over the dog, I frankly found it repulsive. I mean, I said, really? I mean, it's just a dog. And but that's the intellectual of me speaking. I don't feel that way about little children.
Now, there is no, as far as I know, no academic specialty in cute studies yet. How did you get there?
Well, I have been interested in children for a long time. Of course, I've had cute children myself. And when my little boy was about five, he took me into a Walmart and wanted to introduce me to the toy department, you know, sort of like as a scholarly thing, I think he was in his funny little way. And I was astonished at how all the toys were so entirely different from what I experienced as a kid growing up in the 50s, really. And so I thought, what makes something desirable to children? And maybe even more, what makes them desirable for parents to give to children? So from that, I wrote a book on toys and then later got interested in that whole process of giving things to children and discovered that it really is a very modern idea. And part of the purpose of giving things to children was to evoke cuteness.
Now, what makes something or somebody cute as opposed to just pretty or likable?
Well, cute comes from the word acute, which means sharp or maybe even a little conniving, like when you say, don't be cute to your kid. But the word takes on a much broader sense about the beginning of the 20th century. I think when parents begin to look upon their little children as, yes, conniving, perhaps, maybe a bit manipulative, but also nice and adorable in their, shall we say, innocent naughtiness. And so, in a way, the word has this double kind of meaning. It means adorable, it means dependent, it means innocent, but it also has a kind of an edge to it, maybe a bit of willfulness, a bit of spunkiness. In girls, perhaps, a coquettishness, and boys, perhaps a kind of unhousebroken quality, all of which is wrapped up in what we mean when we say cute.
Now, you say the word cute didn't come to mean the modern sense of adorable until not much over 100 years ago, but surely parents, when they looked at children in 1700 or at puppies in 1780, must have thought those things were very cute, no?
Well, they didn't use the word. And although, yes, you do see children with animals and pictures in the 18th century and the like. But what is actually quite striking is just how relatively recent the whole package comes together. Yes, there were angelic children. Yes, there were naughty children in the images of the past. But they often didn't come together in this sort of modern idea of the cute. I think, although certainly people have always loved their children and for a very long time have loved pets, even with the issue of pets, the sort of modern idea of, you know, the toy dog or mm-hmm. That's fairly recent as well. We've had dogs for a long time. They've been our friends, but we've often used them, utilitarian functions rather than our modern notion of pet.
Gary Cross, the historian and professor of cuteness, is my guest today. We can disagree on some of the specifics of what is or isn't cute, but there's one thing that pretty much always looks cute: big eyes on practically anything, from my little terrier pal Fleet to an actress like Drew Barrymore.
Would you like to have breakfast again tomorrow morning, same time?
To E.T. and even Gollum.
Master's my friend.
But big eyes aren't just a marketing gimmick. Studio 360's Eric Malinsky found out how the science of evolution butts into pop culture.
We like cute faces. It turns out it's not a cultural preference. It's not a conspiracy by Disney. When we see big eyes on a puppy or Mickey Mouse, it reminds us of a baby, and we want to take care of it. Some scientists think that this is just a coincidence of nature. Babies seem to have big eyes when actually it's their bodies that are so small. But Dan McNeil, the author of The Human Face, A Natural History, says that we're genetically programmed to think, aw, every time we see a pair of big eyes. Otherwise,
Babies would be in danger. There would be a greater chance of neglect for them. And if there's a greater chance of neglect for a baby, then those babies tend over time not to survive.
So big eyes were a big hit in evolutionary terms. And not just for babies.
If there's a gene inside you which makes you like a baby, your kids have a greater chance of surviving. So that gene has a greater chance of surviving.
So today we see cute people all around us, and we're attracted to adults with baby faces.
It gets transformed. You don't just react to DiCaprio or Christina Ricci as if they're little children, but you do feel the attraction to them. And I think often you do feel like you want to protect them.
John Levy is a casting director in Hollywood. He agrees that actors with naturally big, open eyes know how to earn the trust of their audience.
Certain actors, you know, you have a sense that you could confide in them, that you could be yourself around them, that you could tell them the truth, and they wouldn't take advantage of you. And that is in their behavior. It's in the words they say, but it's also greatly in their openness, and that is often greatly in their eyes.
The disarming allure of big eyes was first measured by Konrad Lorenz, an Austrian animal behavior specialist. Lorenz proved that the baby face, or Kinchen schema, works with all mammals. A mother chimpanzee, for example, will take better care of the baby chimp with the bigger eyes. 50 years after Lorenz's research, Dr. Anna Forrest was working at MIT on the next generation of artificial intelligence. She sees a future where robots are a natural extension of our daily needs, and she wondered if the Kinchen schema could help.
what we did with Kismet at MIT, building this incredibly cute robot that completely fulfills the baby scheme and makes everyone kind of make awe and ah with delight when they see it, to actually make people be attracted to the creature so that the people are not afraid of the robot.
Forrest wants to help people stop worrying about being enslaved to artificial intelligence in the future, like HAL in the movie 2001 or The Matrix. She thinks that if we didn't have to learn complicated interfaces like Microsoft Windows, if we related to a computer like it was a child, we would actually raise computers to be more like us.
Most people interpret the Frankenstein story as the creature that turns against its maker. And for me, the Frankenstein story has a very different subtext. Frankenstein is so shocked by its creature because it's so ugly that he runs away and leaves the creature alone. And therefore, of course, when he never experiences benevolence, how should any good motive and good treatment of other people come from, right, when all he experiences is hate and rejection?
So Forrest and her colleagues built Kismet, an interactive robot that makes MIT scientists gush like new parents.
Hi. You have big eyes. You have big... What? What's that?
Yes, this may be a glimpse at the past and future of our species.
I love you. Aw, did he say he loves me? I love you, too.
For Studio 360,
Hi.
I'm Eric Malinsky.
Hi, baby. You're just like my kitty. I have a cat named Bunny.
You can find out more about Conrad Lorenz and Kismet the Robot at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with Gary Cross, who is the author of The Cute and the Cool. Does it surprise you that human beings can love and coo to a robot if he has big enough eyes and a sort of childish voice?
Well, it is interesting how the idea of the cute is so easily transferable. At one level, of course, you know, we think of it in babies, but very early on in the 20th century, it was associated with animals as well and with cartoon characters. And so there is a certain sort of prototype. I mean, perhaps there's some evolutionary basis for it, but culturally it becomes very refined and isn't invented by Disney, but certainly is exploited by him. And we react not just to robots that look cute, but react, for example, to Disney characters and rides and the like at Disneyland.
Gary Cross, professor of history and expert on cuteness, is my guest today. In a minute, we'll check out the state of the art in cute, imported from Japan.
Hello, kitty. Play with us today. We'll laugh and sing on this lovely sunny day.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and with me today is the historian Gary Cross, author of The Cute and the Cool. Now, you might assume, thanks to Disney and our child-centered culture, that America leads the world in cuteness. But Japan has us beat by a long shot. We tasked our own Sarah Lilly with finding out why the warm and fuzzies have come to dominate this ancient culture that we think of as so serious and ascetic.
I have a confession. I think Hello Kitty is kind of irresistible. Hello Kitty is a round white cat that stands on two legs and wears a dress. The Japanese company Sanrio created the character 31 years ago, and today she's more popular than ever, with children and adults alike. Hello Kitty is decidedly kawaii.
The Japanese word is translated as cute into English.
Anne Allison is a cultural anthropologist at Duke University. She studied many modern Japanese artifacts, like toys. So she knows a lot about kawaii.
It often takes the form of big objects that maybe don't have mouths, like Hello Kitty, or big heads on little bodies. And people talk about the relationships with cute.
Japanese artist Takashi Murakami has his own take. In a nutshell, he's sort of like Japan's Andy Warhol, with his affinity for brightly colored prints and pop culture themes.
The
concept of kawaii has been around in Japan for going on 20 years. I'm not sure of what it connotes in English, but in Japanese it's cool.
Murakami is something of an expert on cool. He started out as a painter and sculptor, but he became truly famous after he inked a deal with the Louis Vuitton company to create print designs for their wildly publicized handbags. You know the white ones, dappled with a colorful variation of Vuitton icons and winking eyes? Celebrities love them, and they've sold like hotcakes. So yeah, Murakami knows something about cute, especially in Japan, where it's all cuteness all the time.
Why did cuteness culture arise? I've been pondering this issue. When you consider that defeat in the war was the starting line for everything in Japan, it all becomes clear.
Wait, so we have Hello Kitty because we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima? I know that Murakami has an equally Warholian reputation for stirring things up and calmly stepping back. Last year, he curated a show at New York's Japan Society, and he named it Little Boy.
When I looked into the history of the A-bomb, I learned that the bombs were named Little Boy and Fat Man. I thought these were highly symbolic. I thought they exemplified current Japanese cuteness culture and otaku culture. That's how Japan is now. We're like children. We are completely oblivious to politics. We don't ponder the place of Japan in the world or our places in Japanese society. We think only about the cute, having fun, seeking what we like. That custom has been ingrained in Japanese.
He talks at great length about his beliefs about this, which are a little confusing. I mean, they seem a little contradictory. And he will say the little boy is supposed to be a play on the atomic bomb that was named Little Boy, and also the little boy that Japan has subsequently become. And that seems to be not necessarily a good thing, but not necessarily a bad thing. There's something disturbing about it.
He seems to be saying that, in fact, it was sort of the basis or one of those originary moments of turning Japan into effectively a humiliated but also therefore infantile society.
Thomas Loesser teaches Japanese studies at New York University.
At the same time, I think there is a real sense that a lot of this idea of almost infantilism, but certainly of childhood, is about innocence that can be played with.
Loesser mentions a 32-year-old artist in Tokyo named Chinatsu Ban. She makes large molded plastic sculptures of brightly colored elephants and baby elephants. They're all wearing underpants.
She's quite open about saying that for her this is a talisman of a kind of innocence that she's afraid she'll lose.
It melts one's resistance. So cute. At the little boy exhibition, before the kitty section, everyone had such a happy face saying, "Oh." It removes barriers. Oh, so cute. I want one. Even the New Yorkers said this.
Whether in a museum or a department store, kawaii is even used to promote Japanese entities to the Japanese themselves. Many towns, villages, or corporate interests have their own invented mascots called Yurukyara. These brightly colored, cartoony figures have strange characteristics and come in a zillion different incarnations, none of which makes any zoological sense. You can't really interpret them. It would be like trying to explain Gumby to George Washington. The point is, Yurukyara have an important function today, as ambassadors.
Why would you have a character, a cute character, be a symbol of a town or community? Well, there is something incredibly appealing about them. You can't really hug a town, but you can hug those.
Ann Allison says there's even a new word for the power that comes from this kind of attraction. It's called soft power. Unlike the more bullying forces of the military or politics, soft power is all about the carrot. It also makes a lot of sense in the context of modern-day Japan.
The culture of cute implies a world which is already entirely and completely a consumer world.
The Japanese government very recently has become very aware that the exports of cultural products like manga and anime and cute character goods are becoming very globally marketable in a way that's historically unprecedented for Japanese culture. And I think there's a sense that there could be a national interest in being able to promote itself as the producer of cool goods. cute is something that's not just out there. It's not just a product. It's something that you feel deeply invested in.
It would be unnatural not to be proud of peaceful, cute characters born out of this peaceful status. We're a 60-year experiment in apathy. These are the kinds of silly cultures that arise when we are oblivious and just think about enjoying ourselves every day.
Nice life if you can get it. And if you get it, more power to you. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Lilly.
Manavara. Manavara. Manavara.
A retrospective of Takashi Murakami's work will be opening at the Brooklyn Museum of Art in New York City next month. For more information, visit studio360.org. Professor Gary Cross is my guest today. I found it interesting in that piece when Murakami says that kawaii, the Japanese cuteness, has in Japan become this very cool thing since in America, cool and cute are virtually opposite.
The Japanese have, in a lot of ways, kind of combined the cute and the cool in the way that that Disney perhaps didn't earlier on. But I also thought that idea that because the Japanese are no longer a kind of a dominating military force in the world, that they have kind of retreated to the cute is a very interesting thing. Because in a lot of ways, that's what the cute did to children in America in the beginning of the 20th century and still does. Before that, toys were often about growing up. They would tell you when you got a doll, this is how you have to look when you're an adult, because the doll looked like an adult and you would dress it like an adult. And so the cute in children's lives is really a signal that this is a time when you're supposed to be apart from the world and not really thinking about either the future or the serious qualities of life.
Why do you think that this Japanese subculture, and more than a subculture at this point, appeals so much to Americans, especially young Americans and young American artists?
Well, it's in part because it's fresh and new, but it's also, it seems to me, it has a lot to do with the fact that these are a series of representations that are so malleable and so multi-sided. The fact that it is contradictory is in many ways a source of its appeal, that you can take a monster and make it cute, for example.
And what about you? Do you, if I went to your home right now, would I find cute artifacts?
You find, like in a lot of people's homes, you find a lot of pictures of the children when they were young.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think makes us, not just my family, but so many families distinct, say, in comparison to 100 years ago, is that we put pictures of children up in our houses, not of ancestors, nor of adults, really. So we have a lot of those. I don't have the symbols of, you know, I have no keen pictures, of course. I, too, was told by my mother, who was an artist, that they were very uncool. I've enjoyed Disney. I have to admit, my friends find this appalling. But there's something really very enjoyable and delightful about the wonder that we project onto children.
Well, another expression of that kind of contradiction I see in this object I'm holding in my hand right now, which the show at the Japan Society gave away. It's this little plastic doll of this schoolgirl in her schoolgirl pack and little short skirt, incredibly short skirt and big eyes. And there is, to me, something, as with much of this of Japanese manga and anime, something sexualized about these figures. What do you make of that?
Well, actually, the cute has always been just a tad bit sexual, particularly in girl form. One of the early cute dolls of the 20th century was called Flossie Flirt, that was sold by Sears for several years in the 20s. And the idea of the cute was to be coquettish, to be sexually alluring in a kind of an innocent way. Even Shirley Temple produced a series of movies called Baby Burlesques before she did the features that Paramount made so famous, where she played Marlene Dietrich, who in the early 30s was a very sexual person.
Well, I remember growing up in the 60s and seeing those old black and white Shirley Temple movies. And I think it was the first time I was actually aware of cuteness as a commodity.
On the good ship, lollipop, it's sweet trip to a candy shop.
Now, that seems to me, with motion pictures in the 1930s, that this kind of mass-marketed idea of cuteness really reached a new level.
Yeah, Shirley Temple certainly popularizes the idea. But in a sense, Shirley Temple is really a sort of a live version of, well, the dolls that appeared maybe about 20 years earlier. They were a whole series of dolls that were designed for a little girl to play with and who often looked just like Shirley Temple, you know, the short, the dimples on the face and knees, and with whom you were supposed to fantasize a friendship and the like.
So there's a history of that. Well, I'm also reminded of Lewis Carroll, Reverend Dodgson's photographs of little Alice, who from our perspective in the 21st century looks like he posed her in suggestive poses. From what I know of that history, that's probably wrong. It was a fairly innocent relationship. Is that because, you know, in 18 whatever that was, that borderland between cute and sexy weren't quite so fraught?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the difference. Today, and in fact, even in Shirley Temple's time, Graham Greene, the famous novelist, wrote a review of one of Shirley Temple's movies that her mother had suppressed on the grounds that Greene suggested that Shirley Temple was being overly sexual. And this, of course, Gertrude Temple couldn't tolerate. But there was something slightly sexual about her. And of course, it's become more so as time goes on with the baby beauty pageants, where that line between the cute and the sexual have really kind of broken down. We all remember
Jean-Benet Ramsey.
Yeah, a few years ago, which was really quite frightening in a lot of ways.
Well, it was. And I certainly had never – I was vaguely aware of that world but hadn't seen the films and videos of kids all made up in their, you know, kind of grown-up lady outfits. I found that very disturbing.
But you see, the cute is always ambivalent. It's about being dependent. It's about being adorable. But it's also about being perhaps just a tad bit desirous. And sort of that's one of the reasons why it seeps so much into advertising. On the one side, if you can make something cute, people want to buy it. But also, if you respond to the child's cuteness, you will respond to the child's desires as well.
So in the cultural lineage, there's a line between a Shirley Temple depiction and, say, Lolita.
Yeah, there's a very close connection between the two, really.
Gary Cross is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we've been talking about a new vogue for cute in the culture. Now, cute is supposed to appeal universally, but some people just don't get it. Gary, a moment ago, said that when he heard our little cute dog at the beginning of the show, he was disgusted. And our friend Tamar Brott has some similar thoughts to share about cutophobia.
Many people in this world do not appreciate cuteness. When they are young, these people gouge their dolls' eyes out and scalp them. When they are older, they tend to go to art school and make friends with other people who find anything vaguely childlike to be sinister. At least that's how it was in the 80s when I was in art school. In those days, the teachers were old abstract expressionists and conceptual artists, and everything was about irony or juxtaposition, which meant you couldn't possibly paint a picture of a bunny rabbit unless it was sodomizing an owl or gunning down children.
In those days, you could not paint a clown without it being a child molester, evil, satanic, kind of horrible clown.
That's Charles Schneider. I went to art school with him.
It was a time when collecting John Wayne Gacy paintings was as popular as collecting bubblegum cards amongst the cognoscenti.
One time a classmate of ours brought in a painting she'd done of a big pink darling baby that wasn't ironic and no one knew what to make of it. I don't know when things started to change exactly, but by the mid-80s, things began to get cuter and cuter. The first time I realized it was in Soho, after seeing a bunch of Keith Haring's dancing stick figures spray-painted on a wall. And I remember thinking, wait a minute, this guy's just being whimsical. Then came Pokemon and Hello Kitty, And suddenly everything was pink and had giant eyes and a head 5 times larger than its body. And art students who once painted pedophile clown paintings were painting elves on toadstools, and no one was laughing at them. The ghastliest part was how all this was manifesting itself in mainstream entertainment, where leading ladies went from 70s hard-asses like Faye Dunaway and Jane Fonda.
I want ideas from you people, that is what you're paid for.
To people like Meg Ryan and Melanie Griffith, some of whom spoke like giant babies.
I have a head for business and a bod for sin.
By then I was working in Hollywood and regularly meeting very educated female executives who spoke like this.
I'm afraid we're going to have to pass on your script.
Since then, even the men have gotten cute. Just compare William Holden and Lee J. Cobb to Matt Damon and Leonardo DiCaprio.
Even really Johnny Depp, in a way. It's like Hello Kitty trying to be Laurence Olivier or what?
The final straw for my friend Tracy was a trip to a gynecologist who had decorated his office in a baby frog motif. There were lily pads all over the desk, she later told me, and frog oven mitts covering the stirrups. It was so upsetting she couldn't take off her clothes. For Charles, who to this day likes to paint cute things being maimed, all this signified the end of the world.
If you notice, one of the warning signs in a relationship is baby talk. If in a culture suddenly everybody starts talking, oh, Wizzy Pie, what is it, little Mookie, Wookie Cookie? When things get too cute, those are warning signals. We're at code orange, so maybe there's a battle, maybe there's a war. Kind of it's the jihad of cuteness to come, I don't know.
But cuteness evolves like everything else, and recently at the car wash I saw signs of where it's going. It was an ad for a doll in the back of a magazine. The doll's name was Little Grace, and she was wearing a hospital bracelet. She was billed as the most lifelike preemie doll ever. That's right, they're making preemie dolls, as in premature babies. Apparently, it's no longer enough to have a gargantuan pastel-colored head and wide, helpless eyes. It seems to be cute these days you have to be fed through tubes and hovering near death, without the slightest trace of irony. For Studio 360, this is Tamar Broad.
And I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the historian Gary Cross. I haven't seen the preemie dolls, but that's amazing. I remember a few years ago in the Cabbage Patch kid craze, there were preemies, but they weren't actually quite so literalized as she's describing there.
Yeah, this delight in the utterly dependent, it comes and goes. Actually, at Coney Island, and this is the historian again, in 1900, there was a display of a baby incubators. So it's something very attractive about life that is, in some ways, is so tenuous.
Do you agree with Tamar that in the last 20 years or so that there has been a kind of proliferation, a glut of cute stuff?
Well, yeah, certainly. I grew up, my mother was an artist, so I know all about all that other, that stuff she was talking about. My mother never did anything that was cute. And I think part of this is a phase, you know, we did that earlier, hardness, which itself was probably a reaction to the cute. But I think it's also, I think, a reflection of the power of those cute images, not only commercially, but in our relationship with other people. It's one of the ways in which we make ourselves attractive to the opposite sex. We make ourselves lovable even if we aren't. And it sends out powerful signals that when friends, it influence people.
I remember being taught as a child, as I was finding Shirley Temple cute, that those paintings by the artist Margaret Keane of those huge saucer-eyed children were just kitsch and beyond the pale, my parents said, and were not proper things for civilized boys and girls to even think about. Are there things that seem too cute by half to you?
Well, a lot of people react to the cute as they do to Disneyland. There's a website of Disney haters, and people, of course, reacted very sharply to Barney, for example, the PBS show.
Yes, indeed. especially his voice. It was a lot about this giant creature having this dopey child's voice that was so
child's
hateful.
Voice, and that is so sweet without any irony, without any aggressiveness, and I think a lot of people, particularly those who maybe don't have children, find it unrealistic and unreasonable.
Well, it was interesting to hear Tamara talk about the expansion of cuteness in the art world, which it's funny how so often in art what begins with a kind of ironic embrace loses the irony part of it before too long. I mean, you know, as she said, Keith Haring, those were just cute little stick figures, or somebody, an artist like Jeff Koons with his giant puppy sculptures. You know, those are almost without irony. They're simply cute.
Yeah. Well, part of the cute that we haven't talked much about is this notion of innocent wonder that in a jaded time is very, very attractive. One of the reasons why we shower our children with things that sometimes aren't even good for them, like candy at Halloween or whatever, is because we want to see in their faces and in their eyes the wonder that we perhaps are no longer capable of seeing reflected in the mirror.
Gary Cross, it's been great talking to you today.
I've had a great time.
Once upon a midnight, in the planet land of X, a young boy being lay dreaming.
Gary Cross is the author of The Cute and the Cool and teaches history at Penn State University. You can find out more about him at studio360.org.
Sweetness never suits me.
Coming up, one of the bright stars of Canada's very happening pop music scene. They even call themselves stars. And they'll play a live set for us just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. During just the past few years, Canada, specifically Montreal and Toronto, have become real hotspots for indie rock. If a new cutting-edge band is excellent and successful, Arcade Fire and Feist are recent examples, chances are pretty good that they live in Canada. One of our favorites is a band called Stars. Their new record is called In Our Bedroom After the War. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So, before we talk, will you play?
We will.
And what will you play?
We're going to play a song called Take Me to the Riot. Slick girls and sick boys, and each one like
That was Stars performing Take Me to the Riot off their new record, In Our Bedroom After the War. And I am sitting here now with the vocalist Torquil Campbell and Amy Milan. Welcome.
Thank you, thank you.
Now, it does seem to me like a lot of your music is powered by this central tension between this sort of easy-to-like musical lushness and these sometimes strange, dark lyrics. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. I think that is sort of Stars' stock in trade, if we have one. You know, a lot of bands a while back, like Steely Dan and Fleetwood Mac, played around with these ideas, and we're just sort of putting them into a more, I guess, more modern, slightly more English context than that. But
What were some of your influences?
Well, the Smiths was a big thing for us. Amy hadn't actually heard of, or you'd heard of the Smiths, but you hadn't heard them.
I hadn't heard them driving through Sheffield with you weeping before.
Who was weeping, you or he?
I was weeping.
I'm from Sheffield, and I get very sentimental when I go to the North because there's nothing like a little grimness and cynicism to make me feel sentimental.
I think it's also the idea that because we are a band that we all take part in the writing process, that we all have different influences as well. And I think that's what makes us unique and not carbon copies of these bands that we might be fans of.
Well, and I understand you are exceptionally collaborative. I mean, you literally all write songs together.
Yeah. Chris Seligman on the piano and Evan Cranley on bass and Patty McGee there on drums. They'll sort of write the music over a time. Torquil and I sometimes take off. Torquil put out a record with Memphis, and I put out a solo record. So we were off, and these guys stayed in the room writing and writing and writing. And then Torquil and I will come in and sort of write the lyrics and melodies. And sometimes we'll write duets for each other on the different records. And that's, I think, the most fun about being in this band for me, is being able to have a partner that we can sing off and play off one another.
Yeah, I think the way it gets decided is it's much like trying to write a script or trying to write a story. You have your narrative that you want to tell, and you have a series of characters, and then you have to cast those characters. So it's like, who's best for the part? You know, like Calendar Girl is like, I'm going to write Amy a Carole King tune, and she's going to be in a sparkly gown, and we're going to win a Grammy, and it's all going to be fantastic, you know? All these bands are extensions of friendships, of relationships, and I think a lot of the strength in what's happening in Canada right now, as you say, is that people are very deeply personally involved with each other. There's not a lot of bands made up of four young men who found each other in the listings of the Village Voice and have good haircuts, you know what I mean? It extends back into childhood and forward into marriage and everywhere in between.
And beyond the fact, as you say, you have all these social connections and lifelong connections with other musicians there. Is the music scene in Montreal sharply different than in New York or in the United States?
Well, the thing about Montreal that I think is hard to understand if you're not from there is that there's two solitudes in Canada. There's the Anglophones and there's the Quebecois. You know, it's the second biggest Francophone city in the world. They have their own rock stars, their own novelists, their own opera houses, and they could care less what a bunch of English kids on the Plateau are doing.
The Plateau being a neighborhood in Montreal.
Yeah, the Plateau is a little neighborhood in Montreal where most of us live, and it doesn't affect the general feeling of that city. And I think that freedom of being ignored where you live is a big part of what's so great about working in Montreal. There is no...
If you play in a bar, somebody might show up. Who cares?
Yeah.
You know that's never going to happen in Montreal.
Uh-huh.
You know that you're going to have to put everybody on the guest list because nobody wants to pay.
Yeah. It's a village.
Would you play us out on another song?
Yes. We're going to play...
another duet called Midnight Coward.
Okay, we're going to play Midnight Coward.
Sweetness never suits me. Get it up to take you.
laughs at the thought of how you're gonna play. How long should I stay? Promises never cease to resist it. And now I'm back on my back, just bite your word.
Starr's latest record is called In Our Bedroom After the War. You can find out where they're touring and also hear another song from their live session with us at studio360.org. And while you're at our website, you can also subscribe to our free Studio 360 podcasts as well as our weekly newsletter. That is our show for this week. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. Our program is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Lital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Malinowski,
Sarah Lilly,
Rob Weisberg,
Katie Rolnick,
Andrea Salenzi,
and Nat Wiener.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, by the Lilly Auchincloss Foundation, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, a young black suburbanite ditches L.A. to try to make it as a rock star. In Berlin.
You know, black men in America live with this business of being feared. So for him, it's a mind-blowing situation. You know, he feels like it's like another planet.
Stu on his new rock musical, Passing Strange. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to PRI Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson. You can find out more about this episode and access our entire program archive at studio360.org.